Hello, friends. This is the second episode of Spoleto Backstage. We're going to head through the stage door to places you can't get a ticket to. You get to meet the people that make things happen and have real conversation with the performers when they're not on stage. I'll be your host, Jeanette Gwynn. Bradley Fuller meets up with Marco Secco, the conductor of the Cola & Son Marionettes production of El Matrimonio Segreto, The Secret Marriage, at the Emmett Robinson Theater on the campus of the College of Charleston. Then we talk to one of Charleston's favorite sons, Charlton Singleton, part of the new hit band Ranky Tanky, to find out exactly what that means. But first, one of my favorite people, Joy Vandervoort Cobb, introduces us to the play Chore Monkeys and why this kind of work really matters. This is the 13th season of the Stella Di Domani series, part of Piccolo Spoleto. So your part of Stella Di Domani is Chore Monkeys. Mm-hmm. You're the director. Give us the storyline.
Okay, so Chore Monkeys is loosely based on this business out of Boston called Task Rabbit. You hire them, they come in, they do chores so you can live your life or something like that. So there are these two main characters whom we watch go in and out of people's homes. There is Peter Mecklenburg, who is a young white cat who is best friends with his other chore monkey, who is Dante. Peter is white, Dante is black, and we watch the interactions between these chore monkeys and the homes they visit. All the homes, except for one, belong to women. So is it a gender dynamic we're watching? Is it a race dynamic we're watching?
And that's where it gets interesting.
Weren't
you the first person to ever direct this show?
I am. I'm really lucky. The playwright, Patrick Gaybridge, who is out of Boston, submitted it to a playwright festival. And he didn't take first place. He got second place. But I loved this script. First, I was intrigued by the title. And by intrigued, I mean angry. The plays were strewn out in front of us, this reading committee. And I was like, does that say Chore Monkeys? And immediately, I was like, the African-American woman in me said, I don't know if anybody recognizes it. That's really insulting. And then I started to read it, and I laughed, and I grew quiet, and I laughed, and I grew pensive, and I thought, ooh, this is delicious. I had an opportunity to interview Patrick. I was teaching a stage management class, and he was amazing. I didn't expect, but he's also white. And there's a question of gender in this play, that dynamic, but there's a lot of white privilege also that is called to question. And the character Dante is written so well that I just assumed it was written by an African-American playwright. And so up pops Patrick, who's a lot of things, but not African-American. So I was so interested in how he found the voice of this character and how it was so clean. And it's because he's raising a black son and a black daughter. And we hit it off really well, and it wasn't the plan for me to direct. I wanted to teach the play and work on the play with my stage managers. But after the interview, I was like, ooh, I want to direct this now.
So, Joy, why are you always choosing plays with hard racial issues?
Am I? That's the stuff I like to talk about. And I feel like, particularly here on a campus, if we use the theater to bring these issues up, to generate the conversation, then it makes the conversation easier to have. It gives people an opportunity to access the conversation in a less threatening way because they're responding to what they've seen in action, on stage, in the relative anonymity of the darkness that they've laughed at or cried with or whatever, and they feel safer in discussing what they've seen because it seems outside of themselves, and then they end up wrestling with themselves. And I mean, that's why I do theater. And this discussion on race in the South has always been, as an outsider, particularly of interest to me.
You did talkbacks after your first performances of this. What happened in those talkbacks?
I wanted to find out how you were changed or not change, what you bought, what you didn't buy, where you saw yourself, where you didn't see yourself. So we decided that, and by we, I mean Ariel Zambrano, who was my assistant director. We wanted to do talkbacks because we wanted to hear what that conversation was from the audience, about what they'd seen, because we were both really moved by this script. And it was much more honest, much more raw than I anticipated. I did not expect to see Black men crying in response to how they felt about Dante and what Dante was going through, these little tiny microaggressions, these little tiny, often unintentional slashes of the skin with these razor-sharp jabs that people don't recognize they're doing, but the person who, upon whom that's falling, is getting cut to pieces. And the men of color who'd sat through the talkback often would end up in tears talking about what it felt like to watch their personal experience being lived out on stage in front of them and what that meant to them to know that, in fact, it is a shared experience and not just one that's caught on video every now and then, because it's not that kind of rage that you see on that stage. These are those everyday tiny little slights that after a while are no longer tiny. And to watch these men cry and respond to that, that was one of the most amazing things. I had to walk out of the first one where that happened because I was about to burst into tears. And I had my little moment outside of the room because I didn't want to impinge upon this brother's moment of real, raw vulnerability in a very public forum. And it wasn't his intention. You could see he was battling it. And it was just so courageous and so heartfelt that I was, whoa, I was so humbled and so touched by his willingness to share, as was the entire room. And there were many nights where, you know, most of my audience was not African American. Most of my audience was white. We were lucky. We had a run of ages from college age to senior citizens. The different way these things impacted the different age demographics was pretty amazing. People saying, I did that, I didn't know that. But when I did that, I didn't mean that. Oh my gosh, did that feel like, and it's important for people to open their eyes to, yeah, that's exactly what that feels like. It's like, I hated that woman in that moment, but I also recognize I do that. And then the actor playing Dante, Javaron Conyers, who's this wonderfully sweet young man, incredibly talented, beginning to tell his own personal stories. And it took Javaron a long time to open up to that because he didn't do much of that even in the rehearsal process. You could see him mulling, you know, and writing constantly, even when I was trying to get him to share. But it was through these talkbacks that Javaron began to share some of the daily hits that even in the Department of Theater and Dance, where we're all from, he's sort of felt victimized by. So it was, you know, it was eye-opening. And the same thing with the kid, Sean McAllister, who plays Peter. He said it was a huge learning process for him. And Sean's this goofy kid whom I often want to just choke. But it was amazing to hear how much he had grown through this process. He's like, I am a different human because of this show. I look at my interactions with other people completely differently because it's the kind of play that sort of forces you to.
I have absolutely no idea how to respond to that. I'm just so glad that you shared all of that. You have another thing going on as part of Piccolo Spoleto. You got a Pecha Kucha happening. There's a night evening of Pecha Kuchas and you're one in the crowd. Have you ever done that before?
No, I've never done a Pecha Kucha. I am terrified of this Pecha Kucha. And that is all I'm going to say about that. So come out and watch me be afraid. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah.
You're welcome. Just keeping it honest. Thank you, Joy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me in.
You can see Chore Monkeys at the Chapel Theater on the campus of the College of Charleston, part of the 13th Stello Di Domani series at Piccolo Spoleto. This is episode 2 of Spoleto Backstage. Thanks for all the good feedback on our preview episode. We love to get your reviews so we can hear what you liked and how we can make things better. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Insta at Spoleto Backstage. And now, opera with strings attached. Bradley Fuller meets up with Marco Secco to talk opera and puppets.
Marco, great to have you.
Hello, good morning, thank you.
This is not only your Spoleto Festival USA debut, but also your US debut. What's that like?
Yeah, well, it's great. It's great to be here. It's first time in America, yes, making music. And it's really, really great. You know, here is a beautiful place, beautiful people, and great to be here. I'm really happy on this.
Your own conducting career goes back to another Spoleto Festival, is that right?
Yes, well, that's amazing because my first professional work as conductor was in Spoleto in Italy. So back in, it was the first year after Menotti's passed away. And I went there to make the Medium, the Menotti's opera. So this is like coming back to Spoleto, but now here in America.
Did that play a role in getting you to this year's festival? How did you get involved with this 2018 Spoleto Festival USA?
Well, it was some years ago, like 10 years ago, I was working with, in my first works as conductor, I was working with Cola Company. That's their staging this year, Matrimonio Segreto. So they called me like some months ago and they told me, we're going to Spoleto and do you want to come to make and to work together? And it's just amazing to work with them. So I tell them, yes, I'm coming.
I do want to talk about this unique staging of the opera in a second. But first, how about a little background on the opera in general? This is Il Matrimonio Segreto, or The Secret Marriage, by Domenico Cimarosa. First off, who was Cimarosa?
So Cimarosa is a really interesting and important composer for Italian repertoire. He was a composer during the last part of the 18th century, and he was very famous in Vienna. And he's like, I think he's the Italian connection between the Napoli world, so Opera Napoletana, that was like Pergolesi, very famous, like La Serva Padrona, and that kind of repertoire. And then the repertory that's coming after that, that is like Rossini. And he's like, with Mozart, I think that he takes a lot of things from Mozart and from this Italian opera from Napoli. He takes everything together, and this opera, and maybe it's one of his masterworks, is like a connection between these two worlds. So it's really interesting.
Yes. So for the average listener, would you say that there are some noticeable differences between Cimarosa and Mozart, or do they pretty much sound like the kind of same sound world?
Well, I think yes. I think that Cimarosa is different because it doesn't have, how can we say, like the German part of Mozart composing part, but he have the more Italian part in that sense. He's like listening, you're going to listen something more nearly to Napoli kind of color of music. But in the melodies and in the construction, that's the most important thing, in the construction of the history and how he traduced that in music, I think he's really near to Mozart. And it's important to remember that the Mozart Nozze di Figaro was in Vienna during, like, I don't remember now the exact date, but it was like in the 94, I think. And then he made this work in the 96, 97. So was there really 3 years after and he was during the first performances of Nozze, he was there. And some of the singers of Nozze di Figaro were too singing for the premiere of Cimarosa work. So it was everything there, you know, composers at that time, they were always listening to other composers and just taking things that were working good and making good impression to public. So I think that he took a lot from that part of Mozart.
So Europe in the 1790s, and you have copyright laws that probably aren't as strong as they are today. You have these composers neck and neck and creatively borrowing.
Yeah, maybe. They were just borrowing. And I think that they didn't have these kind of problems. It was like normal. You know, you made something that is working and people is loving that. Okay, I'm going to work it out because it's going to work for me. And it was really normal for all the composers there.
So as far as the storyline or plot of Il Matrimonio Segreto goes, is it fairly standard for late 18th century opera with a love story among these people trying to have a secret marriage, or what's it all about?
Yeah, well, it's a normal history for this kind of repertoire, this opera buffa. So it's this kind. They take like some characters from the how do you say in English, borghesia, from the high society. Okay, and they were taking that. They were taking like the new person that was having a good business and becoming in high society, and the conte that was in the society, and all these kind of characters. They were putting together and making these histories where there is a lot of confusion. There are a lot of problems. What is happening? And then a lot of how can I say? I think that in modern times is like a Woody Allen film, where this full of this great characters and a lot of confusion coming, and I think that that's that kind of how can we say of work nowadays can be a Woody Allen film.
So opera at this point is moving away from these exalted storylines about the gods and ancient heroes and into the everyday foibles and problems of society at large.
Sure, this is the other part of the repertoire. In that time, like in Vienna, was Salieri, the other composer, and he was composing this grand opera and these subjects of gods and everything. And this was the other part of the repertoire, was the buffo repertoire that Mozart maybe was working in the two repertoires. Well, Cimarosa was working in this. His Napoli part was this thing, working in this kind of subjects.
This Cimarosa opera may be fairly representative fare for its time period and what composers were doing then, but this particular staging that you're conducting isn't so typical. What makes this show unique?
So the unique part, I think, that is that we are working with puppets for this time, and this is really interesting, and I think it's interesting for them too, for the company. Cola Company is an amazing company. I don't know, in the last years, I think they come here a lot of times. And for them it's too a new production, so I think it's going to be really interesting to see that, because they have it like in the repertoire, but as a comedy. There were a lot of like always talking personages, and now we are like staging the opera with all the singers and everything in the pit, and they're moving the puppets on the stage, and it's really amazing, because you're going to see that they make this like wonderful words with this scenography and everything, that I think that in real world is difficult to make it in that way, because they really go for any detail and the lights are changing, and you're going to see a magic world, and it's incredible. It's an experience. It's really an experience.
How do the marionette operators take their cues? Are they looking at you, or are they listening to the singers? Who's the one that they're following for their timings?
Well, I think that it's like they're just like giving life to these puppets, and they're just listening and going through the music with. It's you're going to see it's incredible, because when you are in the public and you are seeing this kind of shows, maybe the first five minutes you are there and you say, okay, they're puppets, and then after 5 minutes it's like real people. It's incredible. You are not thinking about their puppets or not. They are real people. And then when the concert finish and you see the person that are moving the puppets, you say, oh God, they are so little, but I saw it. So, and that's really magic there. Yeah, it's really magic.
Does this kind of staging offer unique challenges compared to, say, a standard opera where the singers are on stage?
Yeah, well, I think yes. In a way, yes, because we have to work like to have like a different way. Because when the singer is on the stage, is a lot of movements are according to music, so it's clear. Some points of the music are clear by the movements that the singer is making. In this case, the puppets are making the movements. So for singers, I think it's really a challenge, because they have to sing thinking about all their movements and everything and all the tempo. They have to say the things in the same way they're going to tell them in the stage, because then the puppets have to make the movements. So it's a challenge to make these kind of things, to find the right tempo to be with the stage and to give them on the stage the right movements and tempos to make everything. That's not easy. It's a challenge there.
Well, Marco, all the best with this upcoming performance, and thanks for taking a little time to speak today.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
For Spoleto Backstage, I'm Bradley Fuller.
Ciao, Bradley. Thanks for the interview. I'm really glad Marco was willing to accept the challenge. Spoleto would not be complete without puppets, and these marionettes really sing. Did you know? You can hear Bradley Fuller live with Sonatas and Soundscapes on South Carolina Public Radio, originating from the Simmons Center at the College of Charleston, Room 101. The rest of the year, it's an arts management classroom. You should stop by and take a peek at what it looks like now. And then there's Charlton Singleton. Artists rarely appear in both Piccolo and Spoleto, much less in the same year. I actually can't remember ever, so if you do, please school me. But first, Charlton with an interview that is equal parts ranky, tanky, and swanky. Let's talk about ranky, tanky.
Fabulous.
What does that mean, and how did this group happen?
The loose translation for ranky, tanky is to work it or get funky with it. We started playing a little over 2 years ago, and it actually, the story goes back a lot farther than that. Myself, along with Quentin Baxter, Kevin Hamilton, and Clay Ross used to play around town as a jazz quartet called the Gradualine in the late 90s into the early 2000s. And Clay moved. We all kind of went our separate ways, but we all stayed in touch, of course. And about 3 years ago, Clay came back and had this idea. He said, you know, what if we played the music of, you know, the Lowcountry or the South Carolina? And his thing was that he had been on tour with his own band and gone all over the world. And, you know, everybody was playing music from their region or their state or their country or something like that. And he basically said, why not us? And at first, Quentin and I, who grew up in the tradition, you know, and everything, we were like, why would we do that? I mean, you know, but if you're not from South Carolina or Georgia or, you know, North Carolina, then you probably, unless you're really a student of it, and you probably don't know a whole lot about the Gullah culture. So when we go out, we find a whole lot of people that don't know, and or they hear something that they didn't know is from the Gullah culture. So that's the quick story about how the band formed.
So school us on Gullah culture.
Oh gosh, well, I mean, Gullah, it's a whole number of things. It's the dialect. It's food, it's arts and crafts, it's traditions, mainly, you know, West African traditions. It has to do with the sea islands that are off of the coast, the Gullah Geechee Corridor, where everybody talks about, starting from sort of the Wilmington, North Carolina area, that southern coast of North Carolina, going all the way down to the top of Florida, maybe right around that Jacksonville area, you know, but all those little islands right off of the coast make up, you know, all of these little sea islands and the Gullah community. And it's still, you know, you can still hear it and feel it and see it, you know, where we live here in Charleston, and especially in Charleston and going down through Buford and other parts, you get to Georgia, it's still pretty fluent. Yes.
All so right. What makes Gullah music distinctive?
Oh, gosh. Well, you start off with the rhythm. There's definitely that Gullah rhythm that's infectious. You may have heard it at a local AME or Baptist church or something like that, Holiness Church. But that's definitely the heartbeat, and it's definitely the driving force behind it. The thing about Ranky Tanky, though, is that we take all of our influences and sort of mash it up in all of that. So you'll hear that beat, but then, you know, on top of that, you know, the song could sound like gospel, could sound like jazz, could sound like folk music, could sound like rhythm and blues, could sound like just dirty gut bucket blues, you know. We mix it up quite a bit.
So how long have you been working as a musician?
Probably, let's see, maybe about 25 years.
Has anything you've ever done had this crazy success of Ranky Tanky?
Not on this scale, no, definitely not. I've been successful, you know, and in what I've been able to work hard and accomplish, you know, as a solo musician, you know, solo artist, and with other friends of mine, we've worked hard and everything. But going all over the world like Rinky Tanky has done so far, that's just been on another level.
What did you think was going to happen when y'all got together and started Rinky Tanky?
We didn't know. Because, and it really came out of left field, honestly. We did a showcase. We were at this big showcase called APAP up in New York City. And we literally played that weekend. We did APAP on a Friday. We went up and did like this little show in Connecticut for a cultural arts center. But it was in a library, which was cool too. On Saturday, and then Sunday we played this other big showcase called Global Fest. And when we left, we were all just sort of chatting, and we said, well, if we can do maybe 10 to 15 shows for the year, that'd be cool, you know, because we still all had other performances and other bands and other things that we led, you know, that we were, you know, still tied to. Well, that 15, I think we had, I don't know, close to 20 offers, you know, to play by that Wednesday after we left. So it came on pretty quick. And at the end of the year, we had done close to 50 shows. And this year, we'll eclipse that by a large number. And it's just been maddening and great and just a wild ride on how it's been growing.
For those people who wonder what APAP is, it's the Association of Performing Arts Professionals.
That's what it means.
Yeah.
Everybody just said, I never knew that. I was making up my own words.
And now you know.
And now I know, yes.
So what was it like when you got that call that said, hi, we're Spoleto, and we want you to perform in the Cistern Yard?
Dream come true. Dream come true. So many years growing up as a little boy, and being gifted tickets to go and see major performers at the Cistern, getting older, and it's just, it was surreal for a second there, because it's Spoleto. I mean, it's one of the biggest festivals that we have around, period. Not just for here in Charleston, but people come from around the world to see this. You know, who'd have thunk that this quote-unquote little local band, you know, was going to be on that stage. It's different when you play, you know, in the Cistern for like a little mixer or something. But when it's Spoleto and it has, you know, that energy and the artistry behind all of the, you know, everything that's involved, it was just surreal. You know, all of us have been in there and have witnessed something that was life-changing for us as artists. And so now we're going to be featured on that same stage out there. And that was just mind-boggling. Just mind-blowing.
Just so awesome.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little sample of Gullah music for people who haven't heard it before?
A sample of Gullah music?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, might be kind of hard to do solo, but I will say this. There's one thing that we do find when we go out and we perform, that there are songs that a lot of people don't realize are Gullah songs. For example, Kumbaya is a Gullah song. Michael Row the Boat Ashore is a Gullah song. We do a version of a song called You Gotta Move. I think a lot of people might know the Rolling Stones version of it. But that's from the Gullah community.
Charlton Singleton. I knew him when. We survived the sweat fest of the opening ceremony, and both festivals are well underway. The rain is not that bad, and the performances are breathtaking. Subscribe now so you don't miss the third episode of Spoleto Backstage, where I talk with two playwrights. David Lee Nelson talks about having cancer, and Henry Naylor opens our eyes to what is happening in Syria. Chore Monkeys continues through March 30th at the Chapel Theater. Ricky Skaggs' performance June 1st in the Cistern Yard has sold out, and Spoleto has added another performance to meet demands on Thursday, June 31st in the Cistern Yard. June 1, Charlton Singleton and friends hit the Charleston music stage with the music of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Rinky Tanky performs June 2nd in the Cistern Yard. One of the classic Piccolo Spoleto traditions is the Harbor Cruise. Music on a boat in the Dark. This year's pick is The Groove Cruise with legendary master DJ Rich Medina. Tuesday, June 5th, boarding on the Concord Street dock at 7:30. I'll see you there. The producer of Spoleto Backstage is A.T. Shire. Executive producer, Sherry Hutchinson. Production assistants are Jenna Feeney, Marley Bryan, Virginia Swift, and William Howell, students in the Arts Management Program. Our intern is Clay Sears. Production in partnership with South Carolina Public Radio, the ETV Endowment, College of Charleston, and Spoleto Festival USA. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Spoleto Backstage. Find us online at scpublicradio.org. I'm Jeanette Gwynn, and I'm your host. See you next time, Backstage.